The following message is the second in his series, Meditations on Exodus.
Well, let me summarize very quickly what we were thinking about last week. Just to summarize, the man or the woman that God uses, I suggested, number one, sooner or later, comes to realize, I've been spared by God. Moses in a very dramatic way. Some of us perhaps less dramatically, but sooner or later we come to realize I've been spared by God, and therefore he has a claim upon me. Secondly, I noted that Moses turned aside to look at that burning bush, and it's at that point that God began to speak to him. The man or the woman that God uses pays attention when God is trying to get his or her attention. Thirdly, he understands clearly that in and of himself he is completely unable to do this job, but to put it into New Testament terms with St. Paul, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Moses in and of himself said, who am I? I can't do this. And repeatedly God says, but I will be with you. Fourthly, he had to let go of his props. Have to let go of whatever you're clinging to. And that was dramatic in Moses being asked to lay down his shepherd's staff and God turning it into a snake and then turning it back into his staff. It becomes the very rod of God at that point. You have to take the snake out of whatever it is you're hanging on to. And finally, there has to be a willingness to dare to believe that God's calling is his enabling. I can't do this in myself, but God will enable me to do this. Moses didn't do too well at that point. He argues with God for the better part of three chapters. God patiently answers every objection, reassures him over and over again that I will be with you, I'll enable you, I'll equip you. And Moses says, oh Lord, please send somebody else. God acquiesces to that and allows Moses to go with Aaron. And God says, I'll speak to you, you speak to Aaron, and Aaron will speak to the people. But that, I suggested to you, was really second best. God allows us to settle for second best. First best would have been for Moses to believe that God really meant it when he said, I'll enable you. I want to pick up the story right where we left off. I'm in chapter 4 of the book of Exodus. And just take a moment to look at what really is a footnote to the calling of Moses before he actually goes and has his first encounter with Pharaoh. Chapter 4 and verse 18. It says, Moses went back to his father-in-law, Jethro, and said to him, please let me go back to my kindred in Egypt and see whether they are still living. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. The Lord said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all those who were seeking your life are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons, put them on a donkey, and went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses carried the staff of God. You see it? The staff or the rod of God in his hand. And the Lord said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders that I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son. I said to you, let my son go that he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go. Now I will kill your firstborn son. Pretty strong stuff, isn't it? We'll come to that in a moment. I just want to notice Moses' great boldness in going to his father-in-law and saying, let me go back and see whether my family is still alive. He doesn't say, God has called me to deliver his people Israel, and I've got to go face Pharaoh, so I got to go now. He doesn't say that. He says, I want to go see if my relatives are alive. Are you ever on your way to a Bible study, for instance, and somebody says to you, where are you going? And you said, oh, I'm going to have my fire insurance updated. Maybe you said that today. You're on your way to a communion service, and somebody says, "Where are you going?" And you say, "I'm just going out for a bite to eat." A friend of mine used to talk about going into a restaurant, and when the food arrived, he'd play "Let's Scratch Our Eyebrows." Did you ever play that game? Why is it we're so shy to talk about what we're up to? Here Moses has the rod of God in his hand. God has just said, "I'll be with you. I will give you signs and wonders, miracles. I am going to enable you to face the ugliest, mightiest tyrant in the history of the world up until this point." And he won't even admit to Jethro what he's about. Wouldn't you think he'd practice on Jethro a little bit before he goes to face Pharaoh? How many opportunities we miss because we don't proclaim forthrightly what we're about. Has this happened to you? I bet it hasn't happened for at least the last hour or so. Somebody shares a problem with you. "Boy, this is really getting to me. I mean, you can't imagine." And you say, "You think that's bad? Let me tell you what happened to me." Instead of saying, have you ever thought about trusting the Lord for that? So simple. Have you ever thought about praying about that? We don't say that typically. We're so shy of mentioning the Lord and His resources. Somebody in our neighborhood is literally going to hell, and we don't say a blessed thing to them because we don't want to offend them. God has called Moses to deliver His people, and he says to Jethro, "I want to go see if my family's still alive." The Lord warns Moses that when he gets back to Egypt, Pharaoh is going to resist him at first, but the Lord knows all about it. The issue is not whether we're going to be successful, but whether we're obedient. The issue is not whether it happens immediately or even soon, but whether we trust God to do what He says. And I want to comment on that very hard business, that phrase, "I will harden his heart," that appears over and over in the book of Exodus. And you wonder, how can God harden Pharaoh's heart and then turn around and hold him responsible for it? And I want to try to explain that. It seems to me it's rather like a psychiatrist who has a client come in, and the psychiatrist perceives that this person has a deep-seated problem of some kind that he's not even admitting to himself. Maybe he's got incredibly deep anger, but he's not even aware of it. On the surface, "No, I'm not angry." And so what does the psychiatrist have to do in order to bring about healing? He has to provoke that person with questions and comments and therapy that will cause that anger to surface to the point that it can be dealt with, right? I think it's something like that. It's not that God is manipulating Pharaoh into a position in which he will do something that he wouldn't otherwise do. Precisely the opposite. God is provoking Pharaoh in a place in which he is already hard-hearted, but allowing that hard-heartedness to surface and resurface and resurface to the point that it finally is dealt with in a decisive way. Hang on to that, because when that sort of thing is said about God, or those words are attributed to God, "I will harden his heart," that's simply from the point of view of God's sovereignty. That's God's part in it. From Pharaoh's point of view, he is acting totally freely. And we'll see how he does that over and over again. He has opportunity after opportunity. God says, "This is what's going to happen, Moses. It's not going to be an easy job. He is going to resist you. The issue is not whether you are immediately successful, but whether you are obedient." We come at this point to the footnote, really. One of the strangest little paragraphs in the whole Bible. I need to warn you, this doesn't have a G rating on it. It's a very tough little passage in Scripture. On the way, at a place where they spent the night, the Lord met Moses and tried to kill him. But Zipporah, Moses' wife, took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, "Truly, you are a bridegroom of blood to me." So he, the Lord, let him, Moses, alone. It was then, she said, a bridegroom of blood by circumcision. Now, before I tell you what I think that means, let me tell you what the most famous commentary in America says it means, the Interpreter's Bible. It says that the passage demonstrates that circumcision was not given by God to Abraham, but in fact it was taken over by the Jews from the Midianites, which is why Zipporah, rather than Moses, is the one who performs the circumcision. She is the daughter of Jethro, the Midianite priest. Secondly, it wasn't their son, but Moses himself who had to be circumcised, and that was a prerequisite to his taking Zipporah on their bridal night. And thirdly, it wasn't the Lord who was seeking to kill Moses, but a demon who had to be appeased by this act. Does that help you? I have to wonder whether we're reading the same Bible. Somebody said, read the Bible, it sheds a lot of light on the commentaries. There are some problems here. There are some significant problems in this little paragraph. The first is that it obviously overstates the case. If the Lord was seeking to kill Moses, Moses would be dead. I suspect, this is my interpretation, I suspect that the Lord met Moses just as he had met Jacob so long before, appearing to him in a human form. And you remember the story about Jacob wrestling with the Lord, or wrestling with the angel of the Lord all night long and saying, "I'm not going to let go of you until you bless me." Sometimes we wrestle with God, don't we? I suspect that's what's going on. It wasn't that the Lord was trying to kill Moses. If he was trying to kill him, Moses would be dead. But he had something to say to Moses, and Moses was wrestling with it. And from Moses' point of view, it felt like his life was on the line. My interpretation is that the issue is not at all that they took this rite, the rite of circumcision, over from the Midianites. Precisely the opposite. The issue is that the Midianites resisted it. And up until this moment, Moses has deferred to the objections of his wife and not had his own son circumcised. This sort of thing is a problem that haunted the leadership of Israel and Judah all down through their history. Husbands marrying foreign wives and not paying too much attention to the religious opinions that the wives bring with them, allowing them to have a significant say in the life of the family and the children. The leader marries a woman with a different religious background, and he accommodates her preferences to the point, sometimes, of compromising his own walk with God and his leadership in the nation. You want some vivid examples of that in the Old Testament? Look at 1 Kings 16 sometime. Ahab, king of Israel, marries Jezebel, and Baal worship is established in the court of the king of Israel. Marries a foreign woman, she brings with her all of her own religious trappings, and he says, "That's fine. I'll still worship Yahweh, but you want to have Baal worship? That's just fine." She almost kills off the whole priestly leadership. Or in 2 Chronicles 28, Ahaz, king of Judah, sacrifices his son to Moloch. How about that for leadership? Solomon marries foreign women by the dozens, and high places, quote unquote, high places are established throughout the land, places of worshiping God in terms other than he told them to, but also places of worshiping the gods. The point is this. This is my interpretation. All we have is what I just read you, but I read into that that Moses has married a foreign wife, she brings with her her own religion, and he has accommodated to that to the point of ignoring God's commandment, you and your son are to be marked with the sign of circumcision. So why does the Lord meet him en route? Because he's saying, Moses, you cannot lead my people out of bondage until you get your own household in order. There's going to be a confrontation between my firstborn son, Israel, and Pharaoh's firstborn son. And before you lead that confrontation, you better get your firstborn son right with me. Not only is your son to be circumcised, but you better get your wife to consent to it, which is why she performs it. St. Paul says to the young man Timothy, if someone doesn't know how to manage his own household, how can he care for God's church? Get your own family in order before you try to be a leader in the church. So I sum up, the man or the woman that God uses has eyes to see when God is trying to get their attention, turns aside to listen to what he says, understands clearly that in themselves they're totally ill-equipped to do this thing, but understands further that God's calling is his enabling. The man or the woman that God uses doesn't shrink from the challenge, and we add to that, the person that God uses is one who works it out in his or her own family before presuming to lead the church. Moses goes and gets Aaron. In the next paragraph, according to the Lord's instructions, he demonstrates the supernatural signs the Lord has given him, and he gets an initial vote of confidence from the people. And in chapter 5, he has his first confrontation with Pharaoh. And we quickly sense the character of the relationship they're going to have. Chapter 5, verse 1. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, so that they may celebrate a festival to me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should heed him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has revealed himself to us. Let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God, or he will fall upon us with pestilence or sword." But the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their work? Get to your labors." Pharaoh continued, "Now they are more numerous than the people of the land, and yet you want them to stop working." That same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people, as well as their supervisors, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But you shall require of them the same quantity of bricks as they have made previously. Do not diminish it, for they are lazy. That is why they cry, 'Let us go and offer sacrifice to our God.' Let heavier work be laid upon them, then they will labor at it and pay no attention to deceptive words." Moses says, "Let my people go," and Pharaoh says, "Not likely. In fact, your very request proves that the Israelis are lazy. Tell you what I'm going to do. Instead of supplying you with straw for brick, you're going to have to gather your own straw without cutting back on the production of the bricks themselves." You know that story. I'm going to move a little faster as we move on beyond this point and try to get an overview of the confrontations as a whole. But I just want to pause at this moment and try to put it into perspective. 10 times Moses will come before Pharaoh requesting over and over again, "Let my people go. God is ordering us, commanding us to go and worship him." 10 times he comes and 10 times he's refused. And 10 times plagues follow as a result. Plagues upon the whole nation of Egypt. Would you just pause for a moment and consider how totally different the story would be if Pharaoh had acquiesced at the outset? Remember, I said last time that the point of the Exodus was that was so that they could go and worship. It wasn't that they celebrated because they finally left Egypt. They were commanded to leave Egypt in order to celebrate. You get the difference between those. It wasn't just that they're giving thanks to God because finally we've gotten out, but they were commanded to go into the wilderness and worship God. Notice Pharaoh's comments, "I do not know the Lord." Some of you might be able to identify with Moses at that point. You're working for an employer who doesn't know the Lord. You've become a Christian. You know things are already beginning to happen inside of you. Things that will ultimately make you more honest, more industrious, more conscientious. You are becoming, among other things, a better employee. But your employer doesn't know the Lord. And so you say, "Would it be okay for me to leave early on Fridays to go to prayer and praise? Or could I take a little extra time on Tuesday to go to Bible study at lunch?" And your employer says, "What? Leave early to go to church? You're not going to leave early. And as a matter of fact, from now on, I want the weekly report on my desk on Friday afternoon, not Monday morning. By the way, no more charging long-distance phone calls to the company. You make them, you pay for them." Any of you identify? You say, "God, I thought I was supposed to go and worship you. Why aren't you letting me go?" You see, what's happening is you're getting a crash course in holiness. The Israelites didn't do all that well with Holiness 101. But consider this. Just suppose that Pharaoh's response had been, "Of course you can go. You dear Jewish people have been working so hard on my pyramids that I'd be delighted to have you take some time off to go worship God in the wilderness." Now let's see. 3 days out and a day to worship. 3 days back, same time next week, right? Instead, God allows Pharaoh to resist more and more and make it tougher and tougher until finally, when the dam breaks, they're gone not for a week, but forever. Really interesting. I'm going to enlarge on this next time, but it's really interesting to see what happens. After four plagues, Pharaoh says, "Go sacrifice, but not 3 days away. Do it within the borders of Egypt." That's not enough. After eight plagues, Pharaoh says, "Go sacrifice into the wilderness, but only the men. Leave your women and children here." That's not enough. After nine plagues, Pharaoh says, "Go sacrifice in the wilderness. Take your wives and your children, but not your flocks." Moses has a marvelous answer. "We're not going to leave one hoof behind. We and our wives and our children and our children's children's and children's children and our flocks and our herds, not one hoof will be left behind. We are going to be obedient to the Lord." And after 10 plagues, Pharaoh says, "Go." And then he changes his mind. And you know the end of that story. Question. When things go from bad to worse, to much worse, to much, much worse, and when it seems like God has told you one thing and He's not doing His part, your prayers aren't being answered, you're coming up against a brick wall 10 times in a row, do you dare to believe that when it's all said and done, it's going to turn out much better than it would have if you had initially gotten the answer you thought you wanted. God bless.